please connect Jim Buggins to my head. He's on television this morning. The anchor person said, he even looks like a conspiracy theorist. So I don't know what that says about Lisa. She calls herself a conspiracy realist. I'd like to start by asking Oliver Stone. It's now, as I said, 50 years since Kennedy was elected, and it's 47 years since he was assassinated. You've done so much to stimulate people like interest in conspiracy, which many people believe in. Why do you believe it is still important after all this time for us to get to the truth of Kennedy's death?
I think it was a thank you, Robert, for the introduction, by the way. I'm really proud to be here. Jane and Lisa, thank you for coming.
Make sure everyone speaks right into the microphone.
It's not that big a room. But it's nice to be here. And you're asking a very fundamental question: why is it important? You know, the movie was almost 20-some years ago, almost 20 years ago. But and the details that I put forward at that time are important to me, important to some of you. But the overall arching question in the movie was always why? What is the motive to kill Kennedy? Who benefits? And that is the classic political question, and that's always been my greatest concern. The motivation. And going back to those days, I remember vividly not only talking to Jim Garrison and many of the survivors of the Dealey Plaza, people who, I mean, I probably know a lot more witnesses of the Dealey Plaza than anybody, except maybe for Chief Lisa from around, who are still left. But the bigger question came to me, you know, from Fletcher Prouty. Fletcher was, as you know, one of the top people in the Pentagon who worked very closely with the CIA. He was what they call the focal point officer, and he worked on missions and training for the CIA. From the Air Force point of view, he provided them with weaponry. So he knew the workings intimately of Alan Dulles. He knew Alan Dulles very well, as well as his brother John Foster. He spent time with him. And he used to always say that he'd all over the world trained Tibetan exiles in Colorado to jump into China and stuff like that. And in World War II, he'd been behind a lot of missions, and he's all over the world. He knew the world intimately. He always was sophisticated about it. He said, I got out of the Pentagon in 1963. I said, the whole atmosphere changed. And his stories in the movie, it's a blend of the Donald Sutherland character, as well as a character that Garrison actually met called Richard Nagel, who's another interesting character. But Fletcher always would say, why? Why was Kennedy killed? And he would always hit on three things. And he would say, Cuba, he was breaking up the ice in Cuba, he was breaking up the ice in Vietnam, and he knew intimately the subject matter because he knew Victor Krulak and all the people who wrote the net. He actually says that he wrote the McNamara report from November 63 that came out. The one that was written in Hawaii. He used to write this stuff in the Pentagon when the guys were meeting over in Hawaii. But anyway, he would write a lot. He knew all the officials, all the NSMA talk, NSAM talk. He knew what went on in the halls of power. And he was always felt that Vietnam, Cuba, and above all, the bigger issue of the Soviet Union, which is where Kennedy made his biggest moves, where the eyeball should go. And he always used to say to me, Oliver, don't. The scenery is for suckers. And the scenery by which he said, if you go down the Lee Harvey Oswald path, you'll never get out of it. It's just made for, you know, to get your head stuck in a pot of glue. You're never going to get out of that. Scenery is for suckers. And I love that line. I used it in the movie. And, you know, stick to the basics. Look at the big picture. And I think that's what Mr. James Douglas has done. He's written a book, beautifully written, beautiful prose, beautiful, almost poetry at times, where he actually not only goes into all the things that the plots, and he's much more up to date than we were, but he goes into why, the geographic and political strategy, and what resulted. And he understands the pain and the loss of this country. Because Kennedy was the first guy since Roosevelt to really start to question the Cold War. I'm working now on this long 12-hour television documentary for Showtime and for abroad, we're selling it to Fremantle. It's a It's called The Untold History of the United States, and I'm not giving up on hitting on this thing again. But we're going into the whole picture of the 20th century, not just Kennedy. And it's a small but very crucial part was John Kennedy's contribution. That he saw a world that was completely gone awry since World War II, and he was trying to, because he had a good memory of Roosevelt, and he knew that era, he was trying to return the world to some restoration of sanity. And he was about, and as James pointed out in his book, 1963 is a pivotal year. So much growth, so much happiness. And it was sucked out. And for those reasons, it's crucially important to the history of the world. Because after Kennedy, we drifted more and more, except for a few feints with Nixon, a few feints with Carter, and a few feints with Clinton and so forth. We have not really ever restored sanity that used to exist in American foreign policy and domestic policy. So for those reasons, I think this book is crucially important. I hope you've all read it. I hope you read it again. I think it's a Bible for those people who care about our country. I'm shocked and I'm stunned that the mainstream press is ignoring the book. It's depressing, and it's true, and it's the way we are as a country. We deserve what we get, and if our education levels are at this rate, we're up Schitt's Creek.
Thank you, Peter.
I have to follow that.
What else is there to say? Lisa, you've been someone who's studied this for so many years, and you wrote an amazing review of the book. What struck you as new for you as somebody who really researched this story?
I'll answer that in the large and the small. On a large scale, the book was new to me because it was the first one that combined a real perspective of the historical context with some specific details about the CIA's manipulation of Oswald in the assassination plot to kill Kennedy. And usually you get one or the other. I've never seen a book that married them so beautifully together. Another thing that was new to the book is it didn't try and prove a conspiracy. It just accepted this is what happened. And it told the story, and it told the important parts of the story. And it didn't wander into these dark little corners, how many shots were fired, what angle. Who cares? That doesn't tell me anything about the world I live in today. But if the CIA killed Kennedy, and the press has been covering that up for the last 50 years, that tells us a lot about America and the challenges we face, and what our role has to be moving forward in terms of standing up to that and being a witness, as James would say, to the unspeakable. In the specific, some of the things that I really liked about that book, the PT-109 incident. I knew Kennedy was a hero. I knew he'd saved his troops. I had no idea how horrific it was. And Jim describes in great detail the ordeal that Kennedy had to undergo and how he almost died several times during this incident. And I think that really changes a person. If you face death at that level, it gives you tremendous power and courage. And that's the courage he had to draw on then when he was facing down his generals and practically his entire Joint Chiefs of Staff during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when they all just wanted to blow the Soviet Union off the face of the planet with nuclear weapons. No other president might have had the courage to do that except one who had kind of already died already. That gave him the courage to stand up. Another thing that was new in his book was the fact that Kennedy also had this secret correspondence with Khrushchev. I knew he had a back channel during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but I didn't realize they'd actually been exchanging letters for some time before that were smuggled back and forth by Norman Cousins and other people. And that was just fascinating to me. Khrushchev's a little bit of a poet. I enjoyed reading those parts. And the talk about how, even though we have our political disagreements, we both inhabit the same arc, and it's important that the arc's journey continue. I thought that was a very powerful message that needs repeating and exposure. Another incident in the book that I found fascinating that I had not ever considered before was Jim's take on the Buddhist crisis. There was an event that happened in 1963 that kind of changed the course of the war a bit and brought a lot of discredit to Diem's government as if it wasn't already in trouble. But Jim makes a case that the CIA might have even instigated the particular event, which is even more sinister given what Kennedy was trying to walk a very delicate line, not put combat troops into Vietnam, but not pull out before the election for fear that, one, he wouldn't get reelected, and two, whoever did, would then come in and escalate the war in Vietnam. And Kennedy felt if he could at least get reelected, then he would have the power. have to pull this out of Vietnam altogether. So that was important, and that particular incident I thought was so interesting. I'd never seen that anywhere else. A couple other things. Key to understanding kind of the whole picture, I think, and Jim does this very well, is the juxtaposition of what was going on during the CIA's plot to overthrow Diem, which Kennedy had kind of waffled on, but never fully supported, certainly never supported the assassination of Diem, which is what happened. At that same time, there was a plot to kill Kennedy, not the one in Dallas, but the plot in Chicago to kill him earlier in November. And at that time, an informant named Lee had gone to the Secret Service and kind of blown the whistle on the plot. A couple of shooters were picked up, a couple others got away. The two that were picked up, we were never given their names, as records were later destroyed illegally when they were requested. They were not preserved according to the laws of our country, and no one got punished for that. What a surprise. The thing that Jim brings to that again is he puts these two things side by side and says, if Diem is killed and then Kennedy is killed right after, then the story becomes, well, Kennedy killed Diem and then Kennedy himself was killed, and he had it coming. And I thought that was a very interesting and important point. But that was kind of, these things are not planned separately. There's kind of a story planned together. And if you think of what happened in November later, then the story became the CIA was trying, Kennedy was trying to kill Castro, and then Kennedy was killed, and Kennedy got what he deserved, even though that wasn't the case. And in my purse and the document I showed you just before our talk, I brought one of the last pages of the CIA's report on the assassination plot. This was a secret report. They wrote for themselves internally. It was a damage control report. Who knows what's already been released, what can we say to the Congress, what can we keep hidden? And in that report, they basically say, can we claim that we had executive authority for the Castro assassination plots? And they say, not in this case. That's right there in their own files. But you won't read that in the mainstream history of this. But you will read things like that in Jim's book. Jim's book, people often ask, because I've been studying this case forever, people going into the Kennedy assassination, and they say, what's the best book on the case? And I used to tell them, well, you've got to read like these five books, because this one's got this part of the story, and this one tells this background, this one tells the history, and now I can just say, read Jim's book, because it's all there. Everything you need to know, all the important parts, it's all there, and it's clear. And what Jim gives us that I've never seen another author give us, he gives us a language framework for discussing the case that is new. He shapes it in this moral context, that we all must be witnesses to the unspeakable being the forces that press for death and destruction, as opposed to the creative forces, for life and peace and moving ahead. And that by denying this part of the history, we are joining hands with that unspeakable. And that when we stand up and we say it was a conspiracy, this is what happened, this is our history, by reclaiming that, we can confront the unspeakable ourselves and help bring the world towards peace. And that's so important.
Thank you, Lisa. I think for the benefit of the people who haven't read the book, we should step back a little bit and maybe invite Jim to comment a little bit more on the meaning of the importance of the subtitle of the book, which is so important. Why he died and why it matters. He's smiling because I put on the subtitle. Once we tried a lot of the subtitles, but it was actually in a meeting, marketing, I was trying to describe what this book is really about. And so it's why he died and why it matters. And we came up with that really kind of says it all, but by answering those questions in a way, it tells really what you're trying to do with the original in this book. Maybe you could comment on that, kind of expand on what all of us are saying, the question of why you got it.
I went for a walk this afternoon to try to think about that. And, there are two sides of that. And the sides that Oliver and Lisa have already addressed and can address, and I'm being perfectly honest in saying this, in greater detail and in greater depth than myself. I'm drawing on Lisa Pease, Jim DiEugenio, Oliver Stone's work, and hundreds of other people, some of whom are out in this audience, and just bringing, trying to put it together. But I've been asked, what have I learned about the why here, and the thing that has astounded me most about the why is not the plot. as sophisticated and as horrendous and as evil as that is. It's the other side of the why, and that's what I was thinking about this afternoon, and especially because of today, and tonight in particular, being the 50th anniversary of JFK's election. So, John Kennedy has astounded me. Why he died involves his choosing as the most powerful person in the world, and up to that point, probably in the history of the world, in terms of his office. How did he come to the point where he could choose to confront the unspeakable, as he did repeatedly through his presidency, to the point where he would knowingly, as I'm sure he did, give his life? You know, that's the kind of power that I can hardly conceive of. And to be willing, in the context of that, to confront it in terms of a resistant position, which I know a little bit about, you know, from being a resistant to various warriors. You do that in the Oval Office? Come on now. That's a fairy tale. Oliver can't tell that much of a fairy tale about Kennedy. I mean, and nobody can, that somebody would have the capacity to turn as President of the United States to the point where he's willing to give his life. That's the why for me. So where does that come from? I think Lisa was suggesting part of where it comes from. It's a man who was very close. He had a raven on his shoulder his whole life. He was near death. His favorite poem was, "I Have a Rendezvous with Death." He was constantly talking about death in a very comfortable way, if you could call it that. And in the last months of his life, he was saying goodbye to people. He knew what was coming. As a very realistic analysis of what happens if you're in the White House and you decide to take a stand at the Pentagon and the CIA, you know what's coming. And then Merton, Thomas Merton, he has this analysis of Kennedy, which is a very negative analysis, 1 year into his presidency. Thomas Merton says that Kennedy is too superficial to really be able to deal with the needs of his office. But Merton goes on to say, in a profoundly prophetic way, that if Kennedy were to turn to the point that is needed for a president of the United States at the height of the Cold War, a point where there's a depth of humanity, self-forgetfulness, compassion that becomes universal, that he would, if he could do that, and Merton says by a miracle, he would be marked out for assassination. And that's both, it could be said to be a prophecy, but it is an exact description of the story as I understood it, as I came to learn more and more about it. Because in the depths of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy broke through into that, especially by his sense of what would happen to the children of the world. Robert Kennedy described that conversation with me. Through Kennedy's sense of what was going to happen to the children of the world, if he didn't appeal to his enemy as he did, and join with his enemy as he did, and together with his enemy work during the last 13 months of his presidency toward a disarmed world, that's what marked him out for assassination. That's the why that is most significant to me, and that I think explains the reason why we're still sitting in this room rather than a nuclear waste.
That's an unfamiliar narrative, though, perhaps too many people in this room don't really know what you're talking about. Kennedy has a reputation as being a kind of consummate Cold Warrior. We take it all for granted that was a great moment, and given the missile crisis didn't lead to nuclear annihilation. But are not familiar with the fact that many people in the defense and military establishment did not think that was a great balance. And in fact, we're very unhappy with the way that we concluded the missile crisis. And of course, there are leftist critics, Noam Chomsky, for instance, who don't believe that the government would have any incentive to kill Kennedy because they didn't fundamentally differ from LBJ. But could you say a little bit, well, maybe even refer to that amazing story about Kennedy's comments on 7 days in May and how that provided a kind of almost a prophecy or blueprint for what happened.
Well, that happened. That conversation that Kennedy had about 7 days in May, the novel which described a military coup toward a president of the United States, who was very famous during Kennedy's administration. He was asked one day what he thought about it, and he was out sailing with some friends, and he said, "Get ready." So, like that, he read it. Amazingly fast reader. And then he said to his friends, yes, it could happen. It could happen. He said, first of all, if you had a young president, this is John Kennedy saying, the youngest president in the history of the United States, and if he had a Bay of Pigs, he's saying this after the Bay of Pigs, he said, there would be some questioning about his capacity to be president of the United States. And he said then, if there was a second Bay of Pigs, a second conflict with his military power and his basically his national security state, he said then there would be a lot of questioning by his military people and a certain shakiness in the whole situation. And then he said, if there were a third Bay of Pigs, he said, yeah, it could certainly happen. It could certainly happen. And then he said, but not on my watch. Not on my watch, the Navy's phrase. Well, of course, yes, Kennedy had a Bay of Pigs, it was a young president. His second Bay of Pigs would have been the Cuban Missile Crisis, where he was constantly and persistently and overwhelmingly presented with the order. If you hear the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Kennedy on tape, go in there and attack, take out those missiles, attack Cuba. He refused, and when he resolved the situation with Khrushchev, by basically promising never to invade Cuba and also pulling back the missiles from Turkey, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were infuriated when they went into the office with him and came out. And LeMay said, we've been had. We should go in and bomb them right now. And then Bay of Pigs after Bay of Pigs after Bay of Pigs came after that, where Kennedy is in conflict over the American University address, over the signing of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, over beginning to negotiate secretly with Fidel Castro over National Security Memorandum 263, where he begins to withdraw our troops from Vietnam, conflict after conflict after conflict, and others that over Indonesia, which Lisa Pease has written about very eloquently, where he basically allies himself with Sukarno and begins to signal his support for third world nationalism. There are all kinds of conflicts between Kennedy and the military industrial complex.
Lisa, you sort of alluded to this connection between the assassinations overseas and the assassination of the president, the CIA's involvement in attempting to assassinate Castro, assassinate Truman, there were others.
Right. I mean,
Jim talks about the kind of doctrine of plausible deniability and how that relates to the assassination coming home, that kind of apparatus is in place there to get the job.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, when Eisenhower came to power, he made two huge mistakes, in my opinion. He appointed Alan Dulles, head of the CIA, and his brother John Foster Dulles, head of the State Department. So he had two brothers running both our overt and our covert foreign policy. The more I read about that era, the more I think we should call it the Dulles administration instead of the Eisenhower administration. And during that time, they changed everything about this country without any democratically elected oversight. And they started running coup plots, and they threw out, you know, the leader of Iran, who had been democratically elected, who was a nationalist. But his big sin, guess what? He nationalized the oil industry there. So we had to go in and throw him out so that the British and American interests could go in and get that oil. How did that work out for us? You know, not so good. You know, 50 years later, we might have to go to war there again. You know, it's crazy. It was this short-term thinking, and they thought, if we can just throw out this leader and get our new guy in. And they did Iran, they did Guatemala, they did in Iraq, and I think it's almost never talked about. Also in 1963, they threw out a person that led Saddam Hussein's party into power, and ultimately Saddam himself. It was the way they did things. And the CIA had all kinds of shields built in. It was a covert network, and I've argued that some people say, well, the CIA is just built to support the establishment. I would argue the CIA was the establishment. When the OSS was created, it was the sons and daughters of the bankers of the Eastern establishment, the rich oil men, and the people who could afford to go out and fund their own operations. And since they were using their own money, no one had any particular oversight, and they just trusted them all to be patriotic and do what's good for America. As that became formalized over the next few years into the CIA, you would think somebody would have tried to put some controls in place. But in fact, the controls seemed to be flying off whatever was suggested. And during Eisenhower's time, Eisenhower was forced, you know, by some of his advisors, said the CIA is running wild, they're doing their own thing all the time. And he actually sent a letter to the ambassador saying, you know what, although you have authority for most things, the CIA can do whatever they want in your country. Kennedy sent the opposite letter. He said the ambassadors are running these countries, not the CIA. And I thought that was an interesting shift. And after the Bay of Pigs, of course, when Kennedy dethroned Alan Dulles and John Foster by then was dead, Robert Kennedy actually went to the State Department and said, are there any other Dulleses here? And if they are, they're out. And they found another one. They found Eleanor Dulles was in the State Department. You know, and so she got the boot, this little old 66-year-old lady. You know, but it's like the Kennedys were done. They wanted a big change. They didn't want that kind of a foreign policy. Kennedy was proposing foreign aid to Indonesia, in like building roads and sending grain, not sending weapons and military. And in Vietnam, as you and others have described, Kennedy was asking the military, try and think more creatively, what can we do besides attacking them to try and win their support? And they couldn't think of anything else because that's their world. That's all they know. And, you know, if you're, what do they say, you know, a guy who uses a hammer, I mean, it looks like a hammer, right? You know, if you're a plumber, everything looks like a plunger. You know, if you're a military guy, everything looks like a bomb, you know? And that was the only solutions they could come up with. So Kennedy then became to them the same as Sukarno or Castro or anything else. He was an impediment to the progress of their actions abroad. And by removing Alan Dulles, it's almost like removing the godfather from the mafia. It's hard to imagine you can do that and not have consequences.
He came back, too, didn't he, the story?
Yes, he did. In fact, do you know where he spent November 22nd? And several days after? At the farm, according to his diary. I assume since he was not a country boy, he was referring to the CIA's training facility back east.
I was referring to
the Dulles Commission.
Yeah, yes, the Warren Commission, of course. Right, in fact, Nkrumah over in Ghana, the leader of that, some journalist was talking to him, what do you think about the Warren Commission? He flipped it open, he pointed to Alan Dulles' name, and he says, whitewash. You know, they know, they know. Everybody outside this country knows what happened. It's only in America that we can't seem to come to terms with it because it's not our mythology. We're the good, the righteous, the land of the free, the home of the brave. This is a story that runs counter to that mythology, and people will protect that mythology mentally by shutting themselves off to the truth.
I think all over your film, you don't have a kind of a, well, maybe it's the Donald Sutherland character, there's sort of a flash forward of what were the kind of consequences, you know, after Kennedy's death, and kind of see all these things that happened that certainly, you know, the war in Vietnam that touched you very personally?
Yeah. So yeah, I agree with everything that you said. It's just very perceptive. Vietnam, and of course, everything that followed from Vietnam. Vietnam, we won. We won Vietnam. That's true. Chomsky is right. We completely trashed whatever, although we militarily perhaps were neutralized and removed. But we achieved the objective, which carried through, which is to trash a country and destabilize politically and destroy its resources so that no other country in that region would challenge the United States, basically. And again, I think it had tremendous effect on all the South American dictators who followed, and certainly gave the willpower to Shah of Iran, gave everybody more confidence in the United States. And yeah, people were blaming the United States for short term pulling out. In reality, they knew the United States was the issue. And Reagan, of course, used the Vietnam excuse for 10, 15 years with Bush Sr., who, of course, used it again and with Iraq. So Vietnam just unfortunately haunted us with Obama saying the ridiculous things he said last year about Afghanistan has nothing to do with Vietnam. I was surprised at how willfully uneducated he's behaving. Seems to me he didn't take a lesson in Vietnam. He really avoided it, perhaps because of pressures. But it's also all these people in Afghanistan, what's his name, the generals, they all make a big deal about, they study Vietnam in depth, and they are, this has nothing to do with Vietnam. They go out of their way, and it's very funny. It's like denying what is obviously is plausible deniability. It's denying what's so evident.
Vietnam.
It's like a big pimple on your face, and you can't look. It's not there.
You know? Well, you know, Lisa, your review, you ran with a headline that said, if there was one book I wish President Obama would read over the holidays, it was JFK and Unspeakable.
Yes.
What was the lesson there?
Yes, because part of what Jim makes clear in the book is that Kennedy lived in a bubble, not of his creation, that the advisors, the only information he can get is what people are willing to give him. And, you know, Kennedy figured that out. He had an early lesson in that Obama hasn't really had, because he had the Bay of Pigs, and he learned right away who not to trust. You know, he knew right away the CIA had been lying to him like crazy. And so he started finding ways around him, which very much threatened that. Obama, I think, still trusts the CIA. You know, he left Robert Gates, you know, former CIA director, now he's running the military. It's like Kennedy had tried to, like, separate those two things, you know, during his administration for a reason, take the CIA out of military operations, and, you know, it's funny that Obama's kind of helped remarry them again. Obama needs to understand the pressures he's facing and that he can choose differently. I think that's the real lesson. Is that there is another way, and Kennedy saw it, and he knew the cost, and he was willing to put his life on the line. I totally agree. He knew he might die. He knew he might be killed at any moment. But he had to do it. It was the right thing to do, and he really believed in what he was doing. And he kept saying to people, it's like, we can imagine another way. Peace is possible. This is not some pipe dream. This is not some intangible fantasy. Peace is possible, and we have to start planning for it. Like you plan for any goal in your life. You set, you know, I'm going to do this, then this, then this, and this, and you set steps towards peace, and then you follow them. And Kennedy was adamant about that. And if Obama came to us with that kind of leadership, peace would be possible. But Obama is either timid, afraid, unable, I don't know. Maybe it's because he really wants to live to see his children grow up. I mean, you know, granted, not everybody wants to die. I understand that. And you shouldn't have to be a martyr to become president. That's a horrible reality that, you know, we're living in right now. And I fault all of us in a way for our collective denial of the truths that might help empower people. Because if we as a country had faced the truth about the death of Kennedy right away, if we had said the Warren Commission is a sham, if the press had told, you know, what people were coming forward and saying, the first paper in Dallas said there were 6 to 8 shots fired. I saw the headline. It's like, you know, that was the official story then, and then, of course, quickly it came all 3 shots, because anything more than that would have meant a conspiracy, so it had to, the facts had to change to fit the story they were trying to tell, not the other way around. And so every time somebody goes, oh, conspiracy theorists, they're actually enabling this denial that allows more people to be killed, that puts Obama at risk, that makes peace impossible. And when we start to say, look, conspiracies happen, here's what happened, here's what we know, and we have to tell the truth about it, and we're not afraid of that, then we enable that peace to become possible again.
Kim, you make that very personal point yourself and kind of relating the cultural deniability in your own being that I'm shared in that for so many years, not connected the dots between your anti-war work and the cause for Kennedy.
My way into this question is not John F. Kennedy, it's Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King. And that's because King's assassination changed my life. It's my baptism. Because I was at the University of Hawaii when it happened, teaching the class, my students were in their draft cards, inspired by studying King, and when he died, they wanted to commit their lives to, against the war in Vietnam, and they wound up going to jail for any time, ranging from 6 months to 2 years. So because of Martin Luther King's assassination, I'm a Catholic worker today, and I'm not at the University of Hawaii or any other university. That was the end of my academic career when I joined the Hawaii Resistance, was their community. And so trying to understand Dr. King's assassination, like trying to understand, you know, your birth, your baptism, your source, just meant, well, as soon as I began to understand that a little bit because of attending the only trial ever held for this assassination, and going in and meeting the witnesses, understanding the nature of the government, this is a, you know, a verdict in a trial, wrongful death lawsuit that, again, like Oliver and Lisa are mentioning, we don't have a media to cover these events. Nobody knows to this day, in terms of the larger picture, that King was assassinated according to a trial verdict by U.S. government agencies. So, learning that, what about JFK? So then comes the question, what about JFK? My denial up until then was total. I had made no connection with John Kennedy's assassination. So the mid-90s, this is supposed to be an educated person who's already investigating or trying to understand Martin Luther King's assassination, but I could not avoid it. I am a very, very late comer. These friends and a number of you are decades ahead of me. And so I'm just trying to catch up a little bit. But the John F. Kennedy assassination and my insensitivity to it for three decades is to me a perfect example of how poorly, for example, peace community people, peace movement people are in knowing, and I know a number of other folks who are like me in that community, with all that has been revealed by people like these two, or Jimmy Eugenio, or a number of you out there, Paul Schrader, David Talbot, I mean, all kinds of people who have brought this information to light, and I was not making a connection with it until fairly recently.
Don't forget Mark Lane.
Yeah.
Mark Lane. Mark Lane was one of the first, and actually, really, he's a very courageous man, and he had sort of endangered his career. He's still alive. Contacted us tonight.
And endorsed Jim's book, Once in a Great While, What Comes Along in Both Records History and Makes It an Exciting Work with the Drama of the First Great Thriller, as Mark Lane wrote, Rush to Judgment.
Book would not have been written without Mark.
I'd like to invite some questions from the audience, and you can direct those to any one of you on the stage. In that case,
first of all, there was an appeal to the Obama administration about it, and the book they were passing around was Gordon Goldstein's book, Lessons in Disaster, which was posthumously published. It was going to be when George Bundy's Look Back at Vietnam, like in retrospect, with McNamara's Look Back at Vietnam. Bundy died before the book was published, and then Goldstein finished it. And it's a really astonishing book. guy is completely wrong because he missed out on JFK with the weapon. And after he read the whole record, he said, no, Kennedy would never have gone into Vietnam. And by the way, this is touched upon in that book, the James Wright book, Virtual JFK, where Kennedy deliberately cut Bundy out of the loop because he knew it was too hard. Him, McNamara, and Bundy on the phone call. And JFK and McNamara are talking about getting out of Vietnam. And Bundy doesn't know what they're talking about. Okay? He goes, we have to find a way to get out of Vietnam, the sooner the better. McNamara says that. Right on the table. All right? So my last comment, though, and this is for the question. You know, Oliver and Fletcher Crowley and John Newman took a literal pasting in the press when his movie came out. And I really believe it was over that particular issue. Okay, because Oliver had a good sense to put that in there and make it the keystone of his movie. You know, that Vietnam would not have happened if Kennedy had lived. And that was probably one of the reasons why he was murdered. Okay? Now, today, I don't know if you know this, we probably do. Today, there's a bookshelf of books based upon this. The Flight book, the Howard Jones book, his book, David Kaiser's book. There's about 7 books now on this. Now, did anybody ever give you any credit for accomplishing what you did? Because if you wouldn't have done that, that shelf of books wouldn't be there. Okay?
No, I owe these insights to Fletcher Crowley. John Newman followed in a way that we helped John to get into this. John did the follow-up research. John Newman is a military intelligence analyst, very dry man, not the greatest writer in the world. But he wrote 2 books, JFK in Cuba, JFK in Vietnam. Am I correct? Those are the top.
Oswald, CIA.
Oswald, you know. Say again?
Oswald is the CIA and JFK in Vietnam.
Those 2 books are really quite monumentally researched. Very, very accurate. But it was, I couldn't get them, Fletcher Prouty's work. We wrote footnotes for the movie called, and we put them out. Wonderful press, a bit like this. And unfortunately, they were ignored. And it was like we made it up. And it was really frustrating. And we fought. We did fight. But we couldn't really get much traction because we had the Hollywood curse on us. And of course, we had Simplify. We had to. You're making a dramatic structure of 3 hours and 10 minutes. And of course, liberties were taken, but my gosh, we had so many footnotes in there. I said at the time, I said, you know, there's 150, 200 things that we raised, and you bring up problems with 2 or 3, 4 things that were wrong. We did get things wrong. But why do you concentrate on the 4 things that are wrong, and you're ignoring all these hundreds of things that you think that were right? It reminded me of what you said just recently. You know, the mindset's still there. Nothing has changed. The concept of conspiracy theorists, if we hear that one more time, I just hate that word. You know, I mean, this poor guy from WikiLeaks, this WikiLeaks, right? Assange? Julian? I mean, I know somebody who knows him and has been with him a while. It's an unbelievable repetition again of the same shit where they go after him. First of all, they don't even acknowledge that he's released so much dynamite. Nothing, no smoking gun, but just a case for the brutality of war and the madness of this situation in Iraq. And he lays it on the line, he gives it right out there, and boom, they go after him for what? For paranoia, for a couple of people in his organization mistrusting him, and for a rape charge that suddenly has appeared out of nowhere based on the man may be a womanizer, but, you know, and there's no question that he likes women, but that's hardly the same thing. And the girl retracted her statement, of course. By the time she retracted it, it has disappeared. I mean, the news is the news, and it moves on. So all of a sudden, the spotlight is on the messenger, not the message. And Julian is the guy who's getting it. But what he's saying is outrageous. And the smart thing about Julian is that, of course, he kept the goods, and he still has the goods online. And that's where the government cannot kill him. Because the moment they kill him, it's going to be radioactive.
I think one of the reasons they went after you so terribly, everybody in this district. Everybody in this district for decades. You know, and then you put it there, you know, on the screen so vividly and memorably. And so not just the mainstream press, but the academia, academic press. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And the AMA, don't forget the American Medical Association. I'm a big fan of Cyril Weck, by the way, who I think is great. Cyril Weck. Fighting these people. And Doug Horne is incredible. That character who came out of this Assassinations Review Board. Doug Horne wrote 5 volumes, put his life into this last few years, and then it's called what, James? What's it called? The Doug Horne thing?
Inside the Air.
There's a tremendous amount of information that is up based on the latest evidence. By the way, when John Conley died, I said, let's take the bullet out of his wrist.
Yeah.
Nobody reported that. I mean, it's so simple. You just take a sample of his wrist and see if it's the same bullet.
I just want to talk about the press and the attacks and why there's media silence. I would encourage you all, when you go home, go to Carl Bernstein's site, you know, the famous Woodward and Bernstein Watergate reporting team. Go to his articles and please pull down the one called The CIA and the Media that he wrote for Rolling Stone back in October of 1977 in the wake of the Church Committee hearings and the Pike Committee hearings and in the early days of the HSCA. He was connecting the dots and he goes, wow, the CIA has major relationships with the New York Times, the Washington Post, ABC, CBS, NBC. I'm sure now we could add CNN. You know, Fox News, who knows? But it's really important, because if you don't understand that, then the rest of it doesn't make sense. Why don't people get it? Well, because there are people planted in the media who will repeat things like this and call somebody a conspiracy theorist, and then others pick it up and echo it. There was a study called the Ash Experiment or whatever, where this guy had showed people these lines of different heights, and he would have these test subjects line up in a room, and they'd all say which one, you know, on this side matches one of these three on the other. And what the test participant didn't know is that everybody else was not part of the experiment. They were all there to mislead him. And so at first, you know, they'd have 7 people, and the test subject was the 7th in line. They'd say, oh, yes, line one, line one, line one. The guy's like, line one. And then after 2 or 3, they would start answering wrong. And a good third of the people would repeat the wrong answer and questioned afterwards. Some of them said, I even knew I was saying the wrong answer, but I was afraid to go up against the group. And that's what happens in the media. When you get a couple of leading lies, Walter Pincus, this or that, putting out a word, it takes a lot of guts and courage that most journalists don't have to go up against them and say, no, you're wrong and I'm right. And we all know what happened when Gary Webb did that. You know, when he tried to expose some Iran-Contra connections here in Los Angeles, you know, a drug ring that was helping fund the Contra operations. You know, the mainstream press went after him. And I actually sent Gary Webb a copy of an article, because Walter Pincus was the first one to attack him. And I sent him a copy of an article headlined by Pincus that said, How I Traveled Abroad on CIA Subsidy, written by Walter Pincus back in 1967. And Gary Webb later told me he thought I was setting him up, that couldn't be true, that was too good to be true. And he went to his newspaper's own archives and found that was indeed a true story.
Tell the story of the lady who did the Warren Commission, went through everything and did the million notes. It's a great story.
Oh, wait, Priscilla Johnson or?
Sylvia Marr.
Oh, Sylvia Marr, do you want to talk?
Yeah, just briefly tell those who don't know. It's a great story.
I don't know her story that well. You tell it, yeah?
This is 1991. Jim, you help me. Sylvia Marr, you know, she went through the Warren Commission, actually read the goddamn thing, which is like a Rosetta Stone. You know, she actually read it. She read every
she indexed
it, and she got all these millions of notes, and she actually put it up on a bulletin board, and she actually studied it, and she came up with all the inconsistencies, and she wrote a book, Accessories After the Fact, which is really unbelievable.
Yeah,
and Long was one of the first ones to really go through the deconstruction process.
You have a question?
Yeah. I can find mostly everybody's dead. The records are there, and if the records, if the records show that the city of Marcella, why did they just release them? So why does this continue to happen? Why do they, why do people think they have to hide this? Yeah.
That is the question, because it applies to all of us, all of us, all of us.
Because it reveals sources and methods.
Yeah. You know, we don't want to go there. We don't want to go there. And if, no matter what profession you're in or what background you are in this country, if you go there, well, of course, you know what happens in your profession, because you are a media person. I mean, this is a question that comes home to me personally. Why on earth am I writing this book? I mean, I am the least competent person on earth to write this story. I mean, I'm not a historian.
That's your advantage.
I'm not any of the things that you're supposed to be to do this. But you know, why, the more basic question, why hasn't it been written dozens of times before this? Now, this is the elephant in the room in terms of our history. Why hasn't Bernstein written this? Why hasn't Hirsch written this? You know, you could go down the list of key investigative reporters. They should have done this 30 years ago. Maybe not 30 years ago, but at least 20 years ago. You know, this has been out there a long time. But as soon as they do that, of course, or start to do it, they lose all access. These people are in the Beltway. They're in the Beltway. They have access to power. And you can't write a Bernstein book unless you can get inside all kinds of sources that are immediately dried up if you start becoming, quote, a conspiracy theorist, which means a decent investigative reporter is what it means, on a hot topic, and a topic that it doesn't get any less hot 47 years later. That's the problem. And if you're an academic, you're marginalized as soon as you start coming out on this subject. And, you know, you could go down the list as to what happens to you in this society if you start following the truth on JFK or Martin Luther King, for that matter, also. Or Robert Kennedy. And this is L.A., so Robert Kennedy in big letters. RFK. What happens to you in L.A. when you go after the truth of RFK?
Did I find out? Not near the police department.
This woman is the biggest expert in the world on the subject of what happened to RFK. I say that without qualification.
Wow, thank you. That's really good.
The New York Times, which has not reviewed James' book, did run a cover story on Vincent Bugliosi's 1,000-page defense of the Warren Commission, in which he said, after this book has been published, all conspiracy theorists should be shunned, like smokers or people who believe in UFO abduction.
Why are Vincent on the show?
Well,
he's being shunned now.
So that no one to be called not just wrong politically, but insane, crazy, marginalized in that way is, you know, a powerful control, not just on scholars, but on insiders from the Kennedy administration over all these years who would never dare to want to jeopardize their credibility by talking about where they are. I want to just allow a few other, many other things here. There's a gentleman over here.
One question I have is for Mr. Stone. Have you considered doing any follow-up to JFK, maybe even a documentary that might focus the state of the research level today?
It's not that I would shy away from it. It's just I suppose it was a big wound in my life. You know, I never quite recovered from that moment because I was having done Vietnam War movies before that. There was quite a bit of a positive feeling about me, and then after that, I became a figure of controversy for years, and it still haunts me. Even if I did a Chavez South American documentary, a small documentary, I got pretty beat up for that one too. So you know, you got to take your licks. I'm not averse to it, and maybe you're right. Maybe I should think about it. But I am doing.
It seems. I don't mean to interrupt you, but it seems that we have one commission, one government commission that says no conspiracy. We have a second government commission that says, yes, there was a conspiracy. And we're left hanging out here coming up to the 50th anniversary of JFK's death. So it might be a good idea to focus some real attention on it.
Yes, I mean, yes, I just feel like, as I said earlier in my opening statement, I just feel like I'm dealing with this in a much larger way. And I don't think it's only about Kennedy. I think it's about a mental state that we're in since World War II. And I think, as you said, the Eisenhower administration has much, much to pay for. And a lot of that dirt on Eisenhower has not come out yet. So we're dealing with a big issue in this documentary, and I hope we can, and John Kennedy plays a huge role, but it's not the only role. It's happened before.
I'm afraid our time here is limited. There's so many people who have questions, and I'm told that we only have time for another question, but Jim will be here for a little bit longer, and we'll be autographing books afterwards. There's an opportunity to talk a little bit more. I don't know how to do this in a fair way, because it just hands all over the place. So I'm just going to say the second row.
Thank you. You're suggesting, basically, that the CIA and the Pentagon is really running the country, not the White House. Look at the Iraq media, what did the CIA that really basically said there was no weapons of mass destruction and the White House really stated the war? Isn't there some inconsistency in that?
There are different factions in the CIA. There are people on the analyst side who can be very honest and say, look, this is what we see, this is what we know. And there's people on the covert action side who have a completely different agenda. And, you know, I'm not going to say, oh, the CIA got us into Iraq or anything. I don't know that. I don't necessarily believe that. But I do think there are a lot of lies that were told. And it is a mentality, as Oliver just said, that has gone way beyond the CIA. I mean, there are factions in the neocons. And one of the things that happened in the 80s that people haven't talked about is that intelligence got decentralized. Because a lot of people got laid off in the wake of the Church Committee and the Pike Committee and those hearings. And they went into private practice, and they started working for Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, you know, some of these other places, and running operations that are completely unaccountable, that aren't necessarily coming from the government, but are still affecting us and drawing the government into their actions. Judith Miller, with all her reporting in the New York Times, who did she work for? Her stories were total BS, and yet, you know, the Times put them out, and they let us write into the war in Iraq. It's like, I don't know if she was a CIA agent, maybe she was working for the NSA. Working for Goldman Sachs, I don't know. Maybe Halliburton, I don't know. But I don't, you know, wasn't on. So that's that I do know.
I wish we had time to ask, listen to everyone's questions, but we have limited time here. I want to thank all of you.